they are not going to, they have no intention of attacking the embassy of America. In fact, they are fighting now to go and start providing security for the embassy.
Especially babies or elderly people are dying. I mean, actually, the day we went there, one baby and one old grandmother died because of the heat and the lack of water.
American policy was essentially driven by ultra-right-wing Israeli religious zealots.
What the Bush administration has done in Iraq offends me as an American citizen and offends me as a Christian.
And there is no democratically elected government which would ever allow Iraq to sell off its oil fields. So they cannot be elections until the oil is taken.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Monday, July 21st, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. At least 50 people have been killed in mortar fire in the Liberian capital, where rebel forces are fighting to overthrow President Charles Taylor. Emergency workers say 18 people died when a shell hit a house in one neighborhood of the rebel-occupied northern section of Monrovia. Media reports say at least 27 civilians and an undetermined number of combatants died in other attacks. People frustrated with a lack of U.S. intervention in Liberia lined up dead bodies outside the American embassy compound. President George Bush said today that Washington is working with West African nations to determine when they will be prepared to send peacekeeping troops to Liberia. He told reporters at his ranch in Crawford, Texas, that Washington is working with the UN to get the latest ceasefire restored between the Liberian government and the rebels. Bush has promised support for a force of at least 1,000 West African peacekeepers, but he has not said whether it will involve U.S. troops. Meanwhile, civilians are being evacuated from the U.S. embassy in Monrovia, which was hit by a mortar shell as 41 U.S. Marines arrived today from Spain to reinforce security. The compound is in the rebel-occupied northern section of Monrovia, where at least 10,000 Liberians have taken refuge from the fighting. It was not clear whether the U.S. embassy was under intentional attack or whether Liberian troops or rebel forces were responsible for the shelling. Sekou Kane is the leader of LURD, an acronym for Liberia United for Reconciliation and Democracy, a coalition of forces fighting to oust President Charles Taylor. He's in Ghana, but is in constant contact with rebel forces in Monrovia. We asked him if the rebels are responsible for the attacks today on the U.S. embassy in Monrovia.
Charles Taylor is killing the people in Liberia, and he is telling the people it is our organization that is doing the shelling. We don't have artillery. It is Taylor that has the artillery, and he's doing the shelling. Taylor have killed people in the American embassy before in Liberia, before during the 1990 war, and we don't want those things to be repeated. This is why we say we don't want ECOMO to come and want Taylor to leave.
So tell us your group's position. You're obviously opposed to Charles Taylor. Who is your group made up of, and what's your official political position with regard to the war?
Yeah, our group comprised of Liberians, and we are committed to the peace process. We respect the rules and laws of the international community, and we respect human rights, and we are committed to the peace process. We don't want Taylor out to have our country back at a peaceful and have our peaceful life in Liberia. The situation in Liberia now, Taylor is the problem. We want him out of Liberia, and we want to ceasefire with all any condition. The problem is Taylor.
Now, Sekou Kane, you're the leader of the Coalition of Liberian Opposition Groups. Can you talk about who these two groups are and that they have recently joined forces calling for the removal of President Charles Taylor, and how significant it is that they have come together?
Yeah, because our objective is the same. It is Taylor. Because of Taylor, we cannot go back to Liberia, and we want to go back home, and we are impatient, and there were war in Ivory Coast, and there were war in Guinea, so we have to rush back home.
What are the demands that your coalition is calling for at this time?
The Liberian people are going to choose an interim leader that will be heading for election. But want Taylor out. In the presence of Taylor, we cannot arrange anything. Mm-hmm. The peace process in Ghana will come to a failure in the presence of Taylor.
We're reading that people frustrated with the lack of U.S. intervention have lined up 18 bodies, one of them headless, outside the American Embassy compound. Did your group participate in this action, and do most people there share the desire for a U.S. force rather than bringing in simply ECOWAS to intervene to stop the bloodshed?
No. We don't expect any U.S. force to come in now. I will say it again, because Taylor want to kill them, and we don't want the American to die on our soil. And we want Taylor to leave, and then the American can come in and help out with security and provide security, including ECOMA. But for now, it's not safe.
And what about the horrific event in front of the U.S. Embassy, where 18 bodies were lined up, one of them headless, outside the American Embassy compound? What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, because the Liberian people, they are confused, and they have to do so, and they want peace, immediate peace. And Taylor is the problem. They need to take the body to Taylor House instead of to the American embassy. It is Taylor that causing the problem in Liberia, not the American. It is Taylor. So let them take the body to Taylor House and let Taylor leave the country and go to ceasefire with all any condition. Mm-hmm. Now.
You're saying you want Taylor to leave. The coalition does. The United the U.S. has asked Taylor to leave. The international community has asked Taylor to leave, and still he's there. You're saying you don't want U.S. troops to come in until after he's gone. I think he's saying he's not going anywhere until other troops come in. How do you see this situation being resolved?
Yeah, you can just go to the American embassy there, and I'm sure they're going to help to evacuate him. Yeah, he agreed to leave. Let him leave.
Sekou Kane is the leader of LURD, an acronym for Liberia United for Reconciliation and Democracy, a coalition of forces fighting to oust President Charles Taylor from Liberia. Investigative journalist Greg Palast has been covering Liberia since leading a delegation to the State Department in 1995. We spoke with him earlier today regarding his analysis of Bush's decision to consider sending troops into that country.
Well, you have to understand is that what we're looking at is the end game of a process begun by the Reagan and Bush administration. You know, I read in the New York Times and other mainstream media that Liberia was started by African ex-American slaves. True, but we have a deeper connection. This nation was a prosperous democratic nation for a century and a half, and it was destroyed when a berserker in 1980, murdered the president, murdered everyone in his cabinet, and him and a band of 18 guys took over the government. The U.S. government, instead of getting rid of these characters, and all we had to do was just say the word and they were gone, the incoming president, Ronald Reagan, decided to shower this maniac with $500 million. More money, by the way, than we've given on for AIDS, for example.
And this maniac's name?
The maniac's name was Sam Doe. And this led, and why did they give him $500 million? Because he pledged, in place of democracy, to make Liberia the staging point and spearhead to fight the Cubans and the Russians and Gaddafi, who are our great Cold War opponents. So to become the puppet client state for the Reagan-Bush administration and obtain the $500 million, the result was that every warlord and every gangster in the region said, well, all we have to do is kill Doe, and we'll get the $500 million. And that began kind of a treasure hunt scramble in which I don't even call these guys warlords. They're groups of gangsters. Literally, they're just gangsters who are trying to seize the government. One of them, Charles Taylor, did seize the government. I mean, technically he was elected, but understand his campaign slogan, vote for me or I'll kill you. He had the capital surrounded, the countryside in his grasp, and without any help from the USA, which had created this mess, people had no choice but to say, yeah, well, my life is worth more than my vote between gangsters.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying that the rebel forces that are there now, or you just see them as various factions of gangsters?
It's more gangsterism. Now, within Liberia itself, there are extraordinary people with a long history of understanding and desiring democracy. the images you get are like, you know, images from out of some old jungle movie. In fact, this is a very sophisticated nation which has been only recently driven to its knees.
Mm-hmm.
And what they do need is some reasonable help, a police force, not a military occupation, but a police force which will allow free and fair elections.
U.S. troops?
Not Iraqi style. I'd hate to see it done by U.S. troops. A police force is what's needed, like an MP force.
What about ECOWAS?
ECOWAS is the economic community of West African states. And while it should be led by Africans, you have to understand that the real power in ECOWAS is Nigeria. And Liberians, for very good historic reasons, would be very nervous about having a Nigerian occupation of their nation. This is one place where actually U.S. troops would be cheered, as long as they would remember that their guests who ought to leave.
Mm. And so you weigh in on the side of having a police force there, not necessarily U.S. troops.
Right, and it has to be. Well, we would need a U.S. presence. We have an obligation. We should have a U.S. police force, which is requested by the people. But we have to remember, I just like looking at Iraq, we've done some polling at BBC and Channel 4. You know, half the people of Iraq were happy to have American and British troops in, and they're getting very unhappy about their guests refusing to leave. And what I'm very concerned about is that Liberia, instead of a temporary police force help, become a continuing occupation. And I'm worried for that because of that three-letter word, oil. It puts U.S. troops on the ground right next to the big oil fields of Nigeria. And we are very well aware, the Bush administration is very well aware, that Britain has basically recolonized Sierra Leone. The French have recolonized the Ivory Coast. And so if the U.S. wants to get in there, we have to have troops on the ground nearby as well. And I'm afraid that once again, in the name of doing something correctly, we might end up doing another Iraq or another Afghanistan where our help seems to have no timeline for ending.
We also spoke with Palast about British Prime Minister Tony Blair's visit to the U.S. Blair made precedence as only the second prime minister to address the U.S. Congress. During his visit last week, Blair received the Congressional Gold Medal, and in his speech to Congress, he asserted that he had confidence in the intelligence used to justify going to war in Iraq. Meanwhile, lying in a field in Oxford, England, not far from his home, was British scientist and former Iraqi weapons inspector Dr. David Kelly, bleeding to death from an apparent suicide. Kelly came under extreme pressure from the House of Commons when he admitted being one of the sources for a report by the BBC stating that intelligence had been sexed up to justify invading Iraq. We asked award-winning journalist Greg Palast whether Blair was in danger of being forced out of office as a result of the fallout from these events.
It's difficult because there's no obvious replacement. First of all, Britain is a one-party country at this point. There's only the Labour Party. Of course, Margaret Thatcher was not removed by the opposition, but by her own party members who can vote her out. And that's what Blair has to worry about, his own party. The one thing that's saving him is that no one sees an obvious replacement for him on the horizon. His own party members are upset, but most are afraid to get rid of him at this point.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the way that this worked is that the information, this fake-o cockamamie concept that Saddam Hussein was trying to buy radioactive mud, yellow cake, from Africa, came from Italian intelligence, was sent to the USA. The CIA said, come on, we've seen this old chestnut and thought it was bogus, sent it off to Britain. And British agents more or less said the same thing. We think that this is nonsense, but we're not going to completely dismiss it yet. And on that weak, weak position of the British intelligence, the White House said, our CIA won't back this information, so we'll cite British intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
British intelligence wouldn't stand by it, but yet Blair still used it himself.
Yes, and when he came to Washington last week, he relied on independent British intelligence that he felt comfortable in citing with respect to this issue. Do we know any more about where this British intelligence came from or what it asserts definitely?
Well, first of all, what he cited almost knocked me on the floor, because what he did was he confirmed one accusation that I had made for the BBC and the Guardian newspapers, which is, yes, he said, you know, not many people know that Saddam Hussein did buy 280 tons of uranium yellow cake from Africa in the 1980s, that he succeeded in getting the material. And he used that as proof that, of course, a new charge must be true as well. What knocked me over about this, of course, what he's saying is that he knew, and obviously the U.S. government knew, that Saddam Hussein was trying to build a nuclear bomb when he was our ally, when the Reagan-Bush administration was in power.
Mm-hmm.
And
In the 80s.
And one of the accusations in my book, in fact, is that the Reagan-Bush administration and the British government knew that the Saudi Arabians had given $7 billion to Saddam Hussein to build an atomic bomb. That $7 billion went to Saddam Hussein as our ally in the fight against the evil Iranians. Remember that this is before the Axis of Evil, when Iran was the unicycle of evil,
mm-hmm.
and Reagan and Bush thought that we should give that Saddam should have a bomb to incinerate them.
So it just goes back to that little joke that's going around. Yes, we know they tried to purchase those materials because we still had the receipts.
Well, that's right. But what was stunning is that in the middle of this press conference, Blair kind of desperately reaching for words let the cat out of the bag that, yeah, someone was giving them nuclear material, us. No one's picking up on this. I did, of course, and which went out to Britons. And
mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's that's the other thing, is that we have a totally different journalistic culture between Britain and the United States. If you saw even the questions being asked at the press conference, there were some difficult, for the first time Bush faced, in his career, faced difficult questions.
Mm-hmm.
Not, does the power of prayer uplift you, Mr. President, but you heard British accents asking if, you know, the information was being faked, and specific difficult questions, which Bush refused to answer. He passed to Tony to do his thinking for him.
Well, of course, the White House has attempted to downplay the importance of the false claims that Bush has made and that he made in his State of the Union address about the Iraqis attempting to obtain uranium from Africa. The administration says, oh, it was merely 16 words out of an entire address, and that the case for war was built on far more than this fact alone. Just how significant do you think this controversy is? And do you agree with the comparisons that some observers have made to Watergate?
Well, it's far worse than Watergate, because Watergate was not about lying to get us into a war. What we have here, first of all, it's not. I hear this 16 words stuff. Okay, let's add 19 words for the con job about the uranium tubes, and how many words do we have for the line that we are going into Iraq to get Saddam Hussein for having supported, harbored, and trained terrorists associated with al-Qaeda. And, you know, that's missing too. Forget the weapons of mass destruction. The real issue here is a war on terror, where we really are under attack in America, and yet he could not find and has not produced any evidence whatsoever of an al-Qaeda Saddam Hussein connection. That's just been, like, you know, whooshed under the rug. And finally, there's another prevarication in George Bush's statements, as well as Tony Blair's, is the promise of democracy. While they were at their press conference, so the news would not get out, in the middle of the press conference, Paul Bremer, our kind of appointed military viceroy of Iraq, announced that elections would be postponed till next year or the year after. So democracy does not seem to involve, you know, what I always learned in third grade was a prerequisite of a vote. And so that's not going forward. So that was another thing that's missing that I would include in the prevarication.
So now we're up from 16 words to...
It's getting up there. I'm looking for the 16 honest words. One of the things that I just broadcast in Britain, for example, everywhere in the world at prime time, there's a one-hour special on the Bush family, everywhere but America, which I reported for BBC television. And it included the news that before September 11th, George Bush had disbanded the team which was investigating the financial connections between Saudi Arabia and Al-Qaeda.
Yes.
Bill Clinton, as it turns out, had sent on, and usually I spend a lot of time knocking Bill Clinton, but apparently he did something fairly reasonable, which was to send two teams to Saudi Arabia with information about how the Saudis were financing Al-Qaeda and other berserkers, and asking the Saudis politely to knock it off. Bush ended those delegations and disbanded the group that was coming up with this very important information.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that gets reported on the BBC, and I know that that certainly upsets the government of Tony Blair, but it doesn't upset the government of George Bush, because you just don't get to hear about it, except, of course, on Peace Watch.
Well, Greg, you also posted an article on your website on Friday after watching the Bush-Blair meeting, and you noted that Bush had used the phrase "Free Iraq" about half a dozen times, even though Iraqis still have not been allowed to hold their own elections.
Yes, well, in fact, the term "Free Iraq" was used by Bush, and he said, you know, we now know that the freedom is moving apace because the Iraqis' own governing council was meeting for the first time and taking charge. Well, it was Iraqi governing council appointed by George Bush. I guess that, you know, it's kind of the democracy that we've gotten used to in, say, Florida, but most people in the world wouldn't consider that much of a democracy.
Mm-hmm. Greg, just for the sake of our listeners who may not be familiar with the story of David Kelly, can you just succinctly tell us exactly that story?
Yes. David Kelly was an arms inspector in Iraq. He's also within Britain's secret end of their defense department. He was the author of some of the reports saying that there was a weapons of mass destruction program in Iraq, but basically it no longer functioned and could not operate. His reports then, and the reports of his colleagues, were sexed up, to use his term, were sexed up by the prime minister, and basically the term "there's no functioning program" was turned into "we could be attacked in 45 minutes. He blew the whistle by going to a BBC reporter. His name was outed as a source, and he was savaged by the government, resulting ultimately, to put an end to the savagery, he apparently committed suicide this past week.
Has there been any development regarding who leaked Dr. Kelly's name to the public?
Well, Dr. Kelly panicked and released his own name as possibly the source. We know that there were at least four sources for the one story that we did run. But Kelly himself had gone to his superiors, knowing that they'd probably figure it out. And you have to understand, there's an Official Secrets Act in Britain. He actually could have faced criminal charges. In America, we have a Whistleblower Protection Act. We have quite a different culture. There, the cult of secrecy is beyond imagination.
The death of Kelly must be causing quite a stir in political circles in England. MP Glenda Jackson has called for the resignation of Blair, Alastair Campbell, Director of Communications, and Secretary of State for Defense Jeff Hoon. Is this a sentiment shared by many, Greg? Is there the likelihood that any of them will ever resign behind this?
Well, it's a sentiment shared by other Labour Party members who have the overwhelming majority in Parliament. Unquestionably, they all are very, very upset. Are they all going to come out and call for their own prime minister's resignation? Very, very unlikely. He's going to face a lot of tough questions. I mean, let's face it, we have the same cockamamie statements about weapons of mass destruction made by our president, and I don't see any member of the Republican Party questioning him. As we saw in Watergate, don't forget, the Republicans like Howard Baker really took after Nixon. And we often saw Republican dissent. That's basically been silenced here. It's not been totally silenced in Britain. But I think that Blair will walk away from this political shootout bleeding but standing.
Now, the BBC story that intelligence experts revealed that they had been pressured to sex up reports and to slant their perspective to support the war caused a major uproar. And the focus seemed immediately to shift to who the source was rather than the facts revealed.
Yeah, isn't that a good game? They've done this to me. You know, I broke the first scandal, Tony Blair's first big scandal, about how Enron was trying to buy up his entire government. They're doing it again. They're going after the BBC reporter who shockingly revealed the information that the prime minister had lied to the public.
Mm-hmm.
And the BBC, my network's being banged, as if we ought to act like Saddam Hussein and maybe, you know, cut off the hands or cut out the tongues of reporters who are bringing in bad news. So the government also savaged, absolutely savaged David Kelly. Uh-huh. He's got this mild manner, Oxford professor type, who was a weapons inspector in Iraq, inside the very secretive Ministry of Defense, and they just savaged him. And so for him, it was an unending tragedy, and the savaging was not going to end, and so he ended it himself by taking his own life.
Mm. Would you say that the media or public has allowed the focus to shift from what was important in that case of David Kelly?
Yeah, I mean, because the focus must and should be, did our governments lie to us? And remember, it's not a question of did Tony Blair lie. This was a joint effort as much as any of the bombing runs.
Any final thoughts on your part, Greg?
Yeah, I mean, what I'm looking at now, in addition, is why we are still there. Not why did we go into Iraq, but why are we still there, and why aren't there elections? And the answer may have to do with a document I obtained, and I must say so did the Wall Street Journal obtain, a 101-page document, which is the post-conflict economic plan for Iraq to be imposed by our government. And it includes the complete sell-off, the so-called privatization of the oil fields and the oil pipelines of Iraq. And there is no democratically elected government of any stripe, of any nature, which would ever allow Iraq to sell off its oil fields. So there cannot be elections until the oil is taken. So, you know, Verna, I don't know if we went in for oil, but it's very clear that we ain't leaving without it.
Greg Palast, investigative reporter for the BBC and author of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. Well, the fallout from Bush's 16 words alleging that Iraq was reconstituting its nuclear weapons program continues. In addition, more information is emerging that there were other misrepresentations of Iraq's military capability. Former press secretary for Senator Eugene McCarthy of Minnesota and political consultant for John F. Kennedy turned academician Michael McCarmichael offers this analysis of the unraveling of the conspiracy to take the U.S. into what he terms an unjustified war.
European audiences are shocked by reports of some of the most explosive revelations about malfeasance in the U.S. intelligence community since the Pentagon Papers. George Tenet's secret testimony to investigative committees on Capitol Hill represents an internecine war raging inside the American intelligence community. The last time that this happened was during the Watergate era, when the CIA was at war with elements in the FBI. One of the most surprising details is that the special unit created by Donald Rumsfeld to spin the CIA and DIA intelligence into propaganda for presidential statements about the dire necessity for war is that Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon had his own politicized intelligence unit that rewrote reports from the highly professional Israeli intelligence service, Mossad, and then fed the Pentagon what were essentially lies. Richard Pearl and Douglas Faith provided the strange and highly unprofessional linkage between Israel and America. Both men were advisors to the far-right regime headed by Benjamin Netanyahu, who is now assailing Ariel Sharon from his political right. This is truly a sordid state of affairs. American policy was essentially driven by ultra-right-wing Israeli religious zealots. And America was misinformed about strategic threats in order to satisfy the fantasies of the most irrational political elements in Israel. This series of events will be very difficult to surpass as one of the most ludicrous episodes in the sad history of American intelligence. It is little wonder that a group of highly respected former U.S. intelligence officials have called for the impeachment of Vice President Cheney. While the impeachment of the Vice President under this Congress, with Republican majorities in both houses, seems like a pipe dream, it now seems likely that there will be a heavy political price to pay for this series of debacles. The major question will be, who pays the political price? The current administration or the legitimate intelligence community and the American people?
Michael Carmichael, political analyst, former press secretary for Eugene McCarthy, and political columnist in Oxford, England. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.